भद्रं धरणे पश्युनुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभीर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Let's go back to verse 5. We've done this, but I just want to talk about it more and then move through to verse 4, I mean, and move through to 5 and 6. Antastanatu bhedanam, antastanatu bhedanam, tasmat jagarite smritam, tasmat jagarite smritam, yatha tatra tatha svapne, yatha tatra tatha svapne, samvritatvena bhidyate, samvritatvena bhidyate. Here the logic is being given, and if you remember in the Mandukya Upanishad, in the Upanishad itself, we're using the Shruti itself as the Pramana. So what the Shruti says becomes the means of knowledge, you know, for the authority for what they're proposing, right, for what they're putting forward. It's true because the Shruti says so. And then there's, but for us, it's true because the Shruti says, so okay, that's one aspect that our mind needs to, that's one part of us gaining knowledge, really. The Pramana has to be there. Here the Shruti is the Pramana. But for us, or for anybody, whatever the Pramana is, here the Shruti is the Pramana, you also need what's called Yukti. Yukti means logic. It has to hold true. What the Shruti says, it's going to be saying things that you can't actually arrive at from your own means of knowledge. Your own means of knowledge are like perception and inference, and basically it's perception and inference. We make six different pramanas, but really those six pramanas are often collapsed, maybe inappropriately so, but they're still often collapsed just into perception and inference. There's other ones. What a pramana is how do we know what we know? That's a pramana. What is the means of knowledge for how do we gain the knowledge that we have? What are the means for gaining that knowledge? One of the obvious ones is perception, right? We gain knowledge through our five sense organs. Another obvious one that we all know about is inference, right? Inference is once removed from perception. All of the other pramanas, in fact, are once removed from perception. So say if we have perception, that's a direct immediate knowledge. Perception, this is going to be important for what we're going to be talking about. Perception is, there's external perception, which is the perception that we need our sense organs to give us. You need the sense organs. For external perception, I need my eyes, I need my ears, etc. I need my sense of touch, my sense of taste, my sense of smell, in order to gain a thought modification, which is then illumined by awareness. Okay? Without my eyes, I can't get that thought modification of color, for instance. So I require my eyes. But there's another type of pratyeksha, and that is called sakshi basya. Sakshi basya means it's simply, the vritti is simply illumined by consciousness. For instance, a memory, an imagination, an emotion, a meditative state. Those aren't being generated by sense perception. Right? Those are the things that the antakarana, the mind itself, is capable of giving me. but they are also direct, immediate knowledge. Like, for instance, I have a sense perception of this room through my eyes, direct, immediate knowledge. There's nothing in between. I have an emotion, direct, immediate knowledge, but the emotion isn't generated by the sense perception. It can have something to do with it, but it's not generated by it. Similarly, a meditative state, similarly, a memory, a fantasy, a daydream. All of these things are direct, immediate knowledge, but not generated by sense perception. That's kind of important, going to be important here, because in both cases, whether I'm seeing something generated by sense perception, or it's just an antikarana vritti, a thought modification of its own, emotion, etc., both are drishyas. Means both of them are objectifications. Both of them are seen, right? Whether it's seen just as in the form of a vritti, thought modification, or it's seen as a vritti, thought modification, which has been generated by sense perception, both are equally seen. For instance, if I ask you right now to imagine a beautiful meadow on a sunny day, that meadow imagination is seen, right? It is seen, it is illumined by consciousness. When I say seen, I don't mean now by my eyes. It's just that that imagination is seen, it's illumined, right? If I ask you to open your eyes and look at the room, that also is seen. But when we think of the room as seen, we think of it in this way. I am sitting here in this room using my sense organs to see the room, right? And so here, when we use see, we're attaching it to our eyes or to even our sense organs. If I want to extend the meaning of that which is seen to that which is heard to that which is touched, it's still, I'm thinking about something that is being experienced external to me, right? But really what is happening is that even though the thought modification is being generated by my sense perception, right? It's being generated by that. The sense, the vritti itself, the thought modification itself is seen, is illumined in the same way that the imagination is illumined. So in actuality, all perceptions are what we call sakshi bhasya. They're in the end illumined by the sakshi, illumined by the witness, whether it be an external perception or an internal perception. You see what I mean? If it's an external perception, all that means is that the vritti, the thought modification, is generated by my sense organs. If it's an internal perception, that means that the thought modification, like an imagination or an emotion or a meditative state, is generated by the mind. It's generated by the vritti. The content of the vritti is generated by the mind, not by the sense organs. But both are exactly the same. That both in the end are internal, because they are, the knowledge that I'm receiving is a thought modification that is illumined by awareness. Whether the thought modification is generated externally or it's generated as by the mind itself as an emotion or a memory or whatever. Is that really clear? So here in this verse, there's two ways of taking this. Shankara takes it in one way and Gaudapada takes it in another way. They both come out to the same thing. It says, antasthanat, just means because of taking place inside, because of having the sthana internal, an internal sthana. So because of being situated inside, taking place inside, being located inside, bedanam. For all of the Vedas, what Veda means is duality. What it means is, but how we're using the Veda, it means two, or that which is divided. This whole universe is divided really into subject-object. There are the things that are known, and then there's the ones who know them, right? And so, like, for instance, in this room, every single thing that I'm perceiving is a Veda. Everything is different from everything else. So every object that I perceive in the creation is called a Veda. And that's on one level. And this body, which is perceived, is also one of the Bedas. It's one of the things. But also, there is the subject-object Beda, where I am the seer and this is the seen. Right? So there's the dual subject-object duality, and then there's the differentiation of the duality of every object that we perceive in the world. Swamiji will say, when we use the word vastu in Sanskrit, the word vastu, vastu, when we're using it with an empirical reality, this reality that we're experiencing through our sense organs, every single object in the world is a vastu. It's a thing. Everything is a beda. So this thing is a beda, this is a beda, this is thing. Everything is different from everything else. It's a beda. And every beda also that I say, this is a vastu, a thing, it's a vastu because I'm aware of it. I know it. So everything that is a vastu is something that is known by a subject. Imagine if there was no subject, no conscious being. Then the idea of subject-object relationship is not going to come up because there's no one to cognize it to make that differentiation. So this is kind of interesting. On the one hand, if everything is totally inert, there is no consciousness at all, so no subject-object differentiation, there is no one to cognize that fact. And so there is basically no problem, there's just inertness and nobody knows about it. Right? It's one big inert thing and nobody knows about it, doesn't bother anybody because there's no consciousness there. Right? And so that is, in a sense, the equivalent of like a deep sleep that you never wake up from, and that never was anything but that, just a big nothing there, I don't know anything, you know. But even then, that's not even fair because consciousness is still there. The meanness of the nothingness is still there. But say there's no consciousness at all. There's no problem of bondage, of liberation. There's no problem of trying to figure out what's going on here. Or no problem of saying, oh, look, there's a subject-object relationship and these are Vedas. That kind of problem does not exist. But for us, in this creation, there are all kinds of problems because there is consciousness. Because there is consciousness in the creation, the consciousness is being held within the creation in the different jiva upadis, right? In terms of the objects when they're in the creation, I mean. So this jiva upadi has consciousness, this table doesn't. So from my perspective as a jiva within the creation, I am experiencing duality. I am experiencing all of these things. All things, actually. Anything that I experience, I'm experiencing all things. But this is exactly what Gaudapada is saying here. What he's saying is that, he says, all of these Vedas that are being experienced, all of them are experienced inside. And he's saying, inside, because all of the things you experience in the waking state are they're pratyaksha pramanas. They're experienced because of your sense perception. But they're still experienced inside in vritti, as a vritti. In the dream state also, everything is experienced inside. Not just in the waking state. In the dream state also, the dream state and the waking state are the same in terms of where you're actually experiencing the thing. So what he says here is, and there's one difference, there's a difference. In the waking state and the dream state, both are being equally experienced inside. But the difference is this samvrita tvena vidyate. The dream state and the waking state are different in that the dream state is taking place inside and it is subjective. Why? Because what is going on in your head, you know, what you're seeing in your head is too big to fit in your head. Like this. Right now, if I ask you to imagine a meadow with the sun and the sky and people walking around in the meadow, or say you have a dream of a meadow, beautiful meadow, and all kinds of things are going on in the meadow, that meadow can't really be existing in your head. Okay? Whereas, so that has got to be, the meadow has got to be totally subjective. It's too big to exist in your head. Another example they use is, you know, these things actually have to be said. Okay. You know? Okay, so we're saying the obvious, but another thing is, if in the dream, say you're dreaming about India, and you're at the temple there, but when you wake up, you see that only 5 minutes has passed, and 5 minutes is not enough time to get to India, mm-hmm. right? So it can't really be real, because you didn't have time to go to India and come back. So it's got to be subjective. One other third thing they say is, in the dream, you could have had a conversation with a bunch of people in India, but when you wake up, none of those people are going to be aware of that conversation. If you go to them and say, oh, you know what we were talking about yesterday or something like that, or just what we were talking about last week, what last week? They'll have no recollection of that whatsoever. So what goes on in the dream reality is different. It's a different reality. It's a subjective reality. It's called pratibhasika. It's a subjective reality. The waking state is different. If you can't just imagine India in the waking state and think that it's there, you yourself would know that that's an imagination, right? To travel to India would take 22 hours. You know that, you know? When you're perceiving something in the world through your sense perception, you don't take that to be inside your head. Even though there is the similarity, and it's a very important similarity. The difference is in the waking, the dream state is subjective. When you're in the dream, it's as though real. But when you wake up, you realize that it's subjective. In the waking state, you know that this isn't just in your head, that there's a shared reality. So there are two different states of reality that we're aware of. One can't fit into your head, and the other one, and seems to, appears to, and this one we don't take it to. You understand what I mean? So there's the waking state and the dream state. They do have a difference, and this is a way of talking about the difference. But there's a way in which they're not different either. They're not different in that both the waking state and the dream state take place internally, right? In terms of the vritti, in terms of your experience. You can't underestimate really how important this is. It's important. It's important because from the standpoint of us as the waker, we can remember our dream and dismiss it as mithya, as an apparent reality, as a subjective reality, as a subjectively created reality. We understand the mithyatva of it. And why we say we understand the mithyatva of it is because, you know, when the dream is actually taking place, it appears to be real. Because when the dream is actually taking place, I am in the same situation in terms of the dream character as I am here. When the dream is taking place, if I'm identified with a character in the dream, I'm experiencing the drishyatva, the knownness of the dream through my sense organs. And that dream, from the standpoint of the dream character, the dream world that the dream character is experiencing, right, that is vyavahara. That is an empirical reality from the standpoint of the dream character. But what the dream character doesn't understand is that the whole dream is pratibhasika, is subjective. So the dream character enjoys its own vyavahara, its own empirical reality, because what I'm experiencing through my sense organs as the dream character, I can't just shift around. You know, I can say it's going to be subject to the laws of the whole dream. The dream character is subject to the laws, whatever the laws are, that are taking place in holding the whole dream together. And so the dream character, through the dream sense organs, can say, you can't say this is mithyal, this is a real chair, this is a real table, I can't just get rid of it. You know? I can get rid of thoughts in my mind, I can get rid of imaginations in my mind. The dream character could be saying this. If I have an imagination, I can change it. Say I have a monstrous imagination, I say, oh, that's just imagination, let me make it into a nice imagination. Or, I have this imagination of a meadow, you know what, I think I'd rather have an ocean scene. I can make it into an ocean scene. Because, you know what, I'm tired of being poor. I think that I'll create some money for myself. In fact, I'm going to create a big pile of gold. So I'll just create that big pile of gold. That's subjective reality. I can do all of this in my imagination. The dream character in the dream can't do that. Unless the dream story, the whole dream projection, is doing that. See what I mean? It's just like I, as a waker, I can't just change this world around. I have to cooperate with Ishwara. Right? If Ishwara changes this whole world around and does this and that and the other thing, then I'm going to be experiencing that. Well, I can say, you know, I want this table to fly. Fly. I can't do it. Right? Don't think too much about siddhis. Siddhis are, yeah, for those that don't worry about that. Siddhis also take place within objective laws. Laws of possibility. Okay? And so what I'm saying is that for the dream state and the waking state, when we start analyzing them, the difference we come to is that one is subjective, one is objective. Both are experienced internally. Both are equally drishya. Their drishya, subject-object relationship, is internal within the dream, from the dream character, from the standpoint of the dream character, seer seen, and from this standpoint, seer seen for the waker. That's on one level, and on another level, both are seen in totality as drishya, because both are this antasthana. Antasthana means both are taking place inside in terms of the vritti, thought modification, which is illumined by consciousness. Whether it be the waking state or the dream state, both are in the form of vrittis, thought modifications, both are illumined in consciousness. One is subjective, true. One is objective, true. That's really the only difference. Right? So this is what Gaudapada is saying. Shankara, so he says, in here he says, so just as there, swapne yata tatra, tatra swapne, just as there, in the dream, swapna, similarly, jagarite smritam, similarly it is to be understood in the waking. What is the same? Because the antasthana, because both are taking place inside, they differ only in terms of the samvritattva, in terms of their size, right? The dream can't take place in your head, it can't be true, it has to be subjective. That's what's being said. Shankara, instead, he adds something to this. What he says is this. He breaks this whole piece of logic. Now, Gaudapada is going to be trying to take what the Upanishad says and make you understand it logically. The Upanishad is just giving revealed knowledge. Now you have to see, how is that true? There's three words you have to know. For anything to really withstand, to be knowledge, it has to have three factors. First factor is it needs a pramana, a means of knowledge. Here, in terms of an Upanishad, the pramana is the Upanishad itself. The Upanishad is taken to be a pramana because it's going to be giving you knowledge which you cannot get through your sense perception. So it's considered to be, within the tradition, itself a means of knowledge. But that means of knowledge has got to withstand yukti, logic, any pramana. Here we're talking about the shruti, the Upanishad itself is a pramana, but it can be any pramana, it can be perception or inference. It has to be able to withstand your inquiry. your logical inquiry. That's called yukti. So you've got shruti, the pramana, yukti, logic, and anubhava, your experience. All three have to be, all three, that has to be able to withstand all three of those aspects. So something's said to be a pramana, but it makes no sense at all in regards to what you're actually experiencing. You can't bring the knowledge of that pramana, you can't resonate the knowledge of that pramana with your actual experience. They say that that's probably not a pramana, it's not functioning. And it makes sense, does not make sense logically in any way. I can't get there logically at all. So without the pramana, the vision that the pramana gives, it must be able to withstand logical inquiry, and it must be able to resonate with your actual experience. So that's very important. That's why here, what Gaudapada is doing, so the Upanishad itself has its own logic, but he's going outside the Upanishad, in a sense, to take the statements of the Upanishad and then look at them logically, so that your mind has to be able to say, as for any knowledge, really, your mind has to be able to accept that knowledge. To accept that knowledge without any type of doubt. You know, it's like in the world, they use the example for this, where we have buddhi jnanam with the buddhi versus the manas. Right? The buddhi means that there is a conviction without doubt, and then you can act on that. They use the example of, one example that Swamiji uses is, say if I go outside and I'm walking down the steps and then I think, did I remember to lock the kitchen door?
What?
Did I remember to lock the kitchen door? If I were to go outside, see if I go outside, did I remember to lock the kitchen door? Unless I have a vritti, cognition, a solid memory of my, oh, yes, I did, I remember, I don't have knowledge. I have to go back and check. When I check and I see that the door is locked, okay, now I can leave. But there's no knowledge. I can't act on that thought if it's vague or if it's fluctuating. You know, you have to be certain. You have to know. The mind has a resolve. So say if we're talking, though that's a simple example, right? So we have examples like, remember to turn the stove off. Say if you're, I had one patient who had an obsessive compulsive disorder, and it was always around the stove. She could think at any time, I don't think I turned the stove off. And she would always have to go back to check. Yeah. But we all have this a little bit, you know. Did I do it? Did I do that? You don't know. So that's not knowledge. It's useless to you. That's not knowledge at all. Moksha is like that. Liberation, when we say moksha, moksha is jnanam. Moksha is atma-jnanam, self-knowledge. It's not gain some knowledge and then do something to gain the knowledge. Or gain this knowledge and then do something to gain the liberation. That would be like, okay, let the Swami give a lecture, let the teacher give a lecture on the knowledge. You try to understand what it is, get it, kind of get it, and then go meditate or something like that in order to realize it. No, you do have to realize it, but that realization itself is knowledge. Realization is nothing but knowledge, you know. And so how to gain that knowledge, especially, see, this is a big problem. Atma-jnanam, self-knowledge, is not a partial self-knowledge. So the knowledge that the Upanishads have to give is that I am the whole, that I am Ishvara. Now, no amount of experiences are going to give you that knowledge. You can have a meditative experience, a non-dual experience, where you just experience yourself just as consciousness, just pure consciousness. Say you've done yoga, pranayama, and all of this, you have pure consciousness, experience. I say experience because the mind comes back from it and says, I just had an experience of pure conscious consciousness. There is nothing else but pure consciousness. And now I'm back here in this world. But the vision of the Upanishad is not that you are pure consciousness, is that there is only pure consciousness. It's that I am pure consciousness, and then there's all of this. It's that there is nothing but pure consciousness, that all of this that you experience is nothing but pure consciousness, that this whole creation is conscious being. To start changing the language, this is pure consciousness. It's like saying the pot is nothing but clay. It is nothing but clay. There's a pot there, but really there is only clay. I have to be able to say, there is nothing here but conscious being. Then I can, if I move the language a little bit, I have to say, there's nothing here but conscious being. If I acknowledge this universe, I have to say, this universe is a conscious being. It goes, that's where it ends up from the Shruti, that this whole universe has for its being, there's two things here, because Advaita, non-dual, this whole universe is one conscious being, which includes me. It's really interesting. If this entire universe is nothing but one conscious being, then there's a question, well, who am I? If the whole universe, because this body, mind, sense organs is included in this whole universe, right? So if this whole universe, the truth of it, is conscious being, kind of like the clay pot, then I must be this. That's one level of the realization. You know, I mean, one advanced level. We've got to go a ways to get that, but the level I am, there is nothing here but conscious being. There's something else that the Shruti says, and that is, not only is all of this one conscious being, but that this whole universe reflects that one conscious being in the same way that my individual mind reflects consciousness. So this whole universe is an infinite, it from its own standpoint is what we call Ishvara, an infinite mind, whereas the jiva that is part of Ishvara is a limited mind within the infinite mind. But the truth of the infinite mind and the truth of the limited mind within it is one conscious being, consciousness. Let me make that clear in terms of the dream. We have the dream illustration, the dream drishtanta. So for the dream drishtanta illustration, we would go look at it like this. The entire dream enjoys the one conscious being, which is me. The consciousness, the existence that the dream enjoys, the consciousness that the dream enjoys is my own being. Is that clear for everybody? Like if I ask you to have a thought of a meadow, you can say, the being of the meadow is me. The consciousness the meadow enjoys is only me. If I have a dream, I would say the whole dream, the being that it enjoys is me. The consciousness that it enjoys is me. Okay? So the truth of the dream is only me. Part one. But there's something else we have to realize about the nature of the dream. And that is, the dream is known. It's not just that it's conscious being, because conscious being isn't a knower, it's just consciousness. Just consciousness, if I get rid of the mind and the sense organs that all belong to within the creation, then within the mind and sense organs, there's knower known, right? But say if I say, all that is pure consciousness. Consciousness, conscious being. Conscious being, and there's nothing else. There's no world, there's nothing else. It's just conscious being. There is no knowership because there's no duality. There's just consciousness. And it's self-evident, but it's just self-evident consciousness. Not self-evident consciousness of something. This is so important. Like, just think of, like, if I use the analogy of the sun. The sun is not performing any act to illumine anything. Because it's self-luminous, things are illumined. But not because it's performing an act of illumining. It's not saying, oh, I think I'll illumine the earth and the stars, today, the sky today. Let me do that. I know it's hard. I have to do it all the time. There's nothing like that. It's self-luminous, and so everything is illumined. Consciousness is like that. Your being is that. Conscious being. It's self-luminous because you are consciousness. So the me that you are, that me is self-evident me. It is self-luminous. It is not performing any action at all. That's just its swabhava. It's its very nature. So now, just to drive this home, in this room, if conscious being is the very nature of everything in this room, okay, only this body, your body, the plants to a limited degree, Tibby, all enjoy consciousness from the standpoint of the upadi, the body, mind, sense organs. But the table doesn't, and the desk doesn't, and the chair doesn't, the rug doesn't, right? Is that clear? You do. But the rug doesn't, and the chair doesn't, and all of these inert objects don't from their own standpoint. Right? Okay, so here are the knowers, and then there are the things that are the knowns. We divide it up like that. But there's something else. There's something else. In the dream, this same phenomenon takes place. In the dream, there are the knowers. Like, say, this is a dream we're having right now. We're the knowers, and these are the known. This doesn't say, I'm a table in the dream or in the waking state. This doesn't say, I'm a chair. But I say, I'm a person. Okay? So we have conscious beings within the dream and in the waking state, and we have inert things. Clear? Now, there's something else, though. In the dream, even though there's conscious things and inert things within the dream, the whole dream is known. The whole dream is like a mind. Now think about this. You're having a dream, and in the dream, there's no people in the dream. There's just, or maybe there's people nobody you've identified with. Or there's no people. Maybe there's just scenery. The whole dream is known. The dream doesn't require people. From its own standpoint, it's like an infinite mind. Just like if I ask you to imagine a meadow with no people, no animals, then just that mind, that meadow is known. Now I ask you to put some people in it. And if you, once you start daydreaming, say you put people in your meadow, and you start daydreaming, then those people have a life of their own and they're seeing out of their sense organs, and then they're little jivas experiencing the objects in the meadow. But the whole meadow also is known from its own standpoint. This is what the Upanishad has to say. This whole universe as Ishvara, you can say that this whole universe is nothing but conscious being. Just like I could say like this, the whole ocean with all of the waves that make up the ocean of infinite number of sizes and varieties, all of those waves make up one big ocean, but really there's just nothing there but water, inert water. That's not what's happening. That's not what's being said. We use the wave ocean just to show that all of the waves in the ocean are really nothing but water. But there's something else that we have to recognize here. And that is, just as your mind, the whole mind, enjoys consciousness, reflects consciousness. That's why Swamiji has started calling the mind and the whole creation as manifest knowledge. Your mind as limited manifest knowledge. The creation as limitless manifest knowledge. Why does he say that? Because if I ask you right now to think of a car, think of your car. If you don't have a car, your partner's car. Think of a car, your car. What comes to mind is the manifestation of the unmanifest car knowledge. Right? If I ask you to think of a pine tree, what comes? The manifestation of the unmanifest pine tree knowledge. Until I ask you to think of a pine tree, you probably don't have any particular pine tree, but maybe you know what a pine tree looks like. Now think of an apple tree or a redwood tree. What was lurking there in unmanifest knowledge comes as manifest knowledge, right? Because it had to be there in unmanifest condition for you to bring it into manifestation. What does it mean when it comes into manifestation is that the tree is known, the car is known. Whatever knowledge you bring into manifestation, it is known. Now, when I ask you to bring a meadow, think of a meadow. Now, the meadow knowledge that was in unmanifest condition becomes manifest. What does that mean? It is known. Right? So now, what if I ask you to imagine the solar system, what you learned in school, with your own version. Imagine the solar system. So now that solar system from the third grade or whenever high school, now that solar system that was lurking there in your unconscious as unmanifest knowledge is now manifest. Do you understand? Ishwara is the same, but Ishwara is the total unmanifest knowledge becomes manifest. Goes into unmanifest knowledge becomes manifest. What does that mean? When the creation is manifest, the creation from its own standpoint is known. Because the creation is pervaded, well, if we want to get into details, just take this or leave it, but some of you know about this and some don't know less. When we say that the Maya comes into manifestation, the Maya which is made of sattva, rajas, and tamas, Maya being that creative, you know, potential that manifests as the creation. It's made of sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is pervasive. Rajas is pervasive. Tamas is pervasive. Sattva is that which allows for the reflection of consciousness, like your mind and your sense organs. Sattva pervades the whole creation. Rajas is what allows the body to move. It's the activity. It's the energy. Rajas pervades the entire creation. Tamas is what allows for physicality, for nama-rupa, for forms. That's tamas, pervades the entire creation. And so from your standpoint, your limited mind is sattva. The sattva that pervades, that allows for the reflection or manifestation of consciousness is abiding, it's a subtle body, is abiding here in this tamas, in this physical body that is filled with prana, the rajas. But your experience of the manas is of the mind is limited. The sattva that you experience just in terms of your upadhi is limited, whereas the sattva, from the standpoint of the whole creation, is limitless. And so your relationship to your mind is Ishwara's relationship to the entire creation. In that your mind, when your mind is up, it is known. Right? And you have a limited unconscious. You have limited unmanifest knowledge from the standpoint of the jiva. From the standpoint of Ishwara, there is limitless unmanifest knowledge that becomes manifest cyclically and over time. But the point, what I'm saying here, is that to have the knowledge that the Upanishad has to give is not just awareness. It's there is nothing but awareness. That awareness is like the clay pot, the very substance of this whole creation, and this whole creation is Ishwara. Ishwara means like I am a jiva, this creation is Ishwara. Means not only is its truth one conscious being, from the standpoint of the creation, that one conscious being is what we call Ishwara. Rather than saying, this entire creation, its truth is consciousness. Mother Nature is consciousness. It's conscious being. Mother Nature, this whole creation, is conscious being. But I, as a jiva, being part of Mother Nature, I have the special quality of having a subtle body that allows me to reflect consciousness. So I then become a conscious being, seemingly enjoying the consciousness of the truth of this creation, I become a conscious being walking around in unconscious Mother Nature, which is itself has for its truth consciousness. That's not what it is. That's wrong. That is wrong.
Oh, wait a minute. I just learned that now.
I really want you to understand this stuff. I'm blowing it a little bit. Let me
know. No, okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. So, because this, we're back in samsara now. The instant you do that, we're back in samsara. Because even though if you say the underlying reality of this creation is conscious being, and that conscious being is you, there is only one conscious being. There is no release from the jiva, for the jiva, really. Because you are still a, from the standpoint of the upadi, the body, mind, sense organs, in terms of this whole creation, you are the conscious being, not the creation. You are a conscious being. See, like right now, you can say, I am the conscious being, the table isn't. The table is pure conscious being, and I am pure conscious being, but from the standpoint of this creation, I am the conscious being, not the table. Do you see what I mean? Like, say, in the dream. The dream character is the conscious being, not the rock that the dream character is sitting on. Right? Both have for their truth conscious being, and that truth is me, I can say. But from the standpoint of the creation, I am a conscious being and the rock isn't. That's true. Even though both are equally consciousness. But that's not what the Upanishad is saying. From the standpoint the Upanishad is saying is Ishwara. Ishwara means the whole Maya Upadi, because of the sattva, itself is manifest knowledge. So the entire creation is known, just like when you have a dream, if you think of lucid dreams. Lucid dream is a little bit closer. Imagination is even closer. If you have a lucid dream, the whole dream is known. The characters within the dream are known and knowing, right? And then the objects within the dream, from their own standpoint, they're not known, but from the standpoint of Ishwara, they're illumined. That's what it's like for you in the dream. That's what we mean by Ishwara in this waking state. When that is the situation, when we say this is moksha, this understanding is that there is nothing but me here. I am the conscious being which this whole creation enjoys. Number one, I recognize that, and I recognize my own freedom in that. I am the satyam of this mitya creation. So I recognize that freedom from just my standpoint. But then from the standpoint of this jiva-ishwara, beda, this duality between jiva and ishwara, which the samsari suffers from. There's a duality between the jiva and ishwara. Okay? That jiva-ishwara beda goes, totally. What that means is that there still is one conscious being, which is me, and there is one conscious ishwara, of which this body, mind, sense organs is a part. And that Ishwara is also me. That's because I am the self of Ishwara. That means that this body, mind, sense organs belongs to the self, which is Ishwara. So in fact, any resolution on the part of the jiva is not into Brahman, it is into Ishwara. This body, mind, sense organs has to recognize that it is part and parcel of a greater me, of a greater knowledge, that this body, mind, sense organs is part of a bigger picture, of a bigger story, of Ishwara's story. Just like your dream character, look at how much the dream character is part of the dream story. We don't say that the dream character really has free will. It's like in most of the lokas that you go to as you are transmigrating, you go to different lokas. Most of those lokas, except for the Satya loka, there's no free will. There's just the exhaustion of experience. And in the dream, it's like that too. Here, the only difference between the dream state and here besides the subjective-objective, I mean, but in terms of comparing the two, the dream character is really living out, simply living out the prarabdha, the total karma of the dream. That is our situation also. This body, mind, sense organs is really living out the total karma, the prarabdha karma. Our problem is that we have free will. And so our free will is always butting up against the prarabdha karma. You know? And we're happy when our free will and our desires are going along with our prarabdha karma because everything works so well. And when our free will is not going along with the prarabdha karma, everything works so badly. And why is Ishvara being so mean to me? You know, and why is this happening to me? Why am I so unlucky? Because the desires I've accrued in this lifetime are not matching up with my prarabdha karma. Or the karma is just in a bad spell, because the karma also is 50-50, punya and papa. But my jiva srishti, the projection of the jiva on top of the prarabdha karma, is really creates a lot of angst for me, because my projections, I'm picking up my likes and dislikes, I'm picking up from my experiences. These people, look at how happy they are, and look at what this person has, and if I could have this or that, I would be happy. I would be happier, you know. And so the prarabdha you already have. That's the big problem for a samsari, is the prarabdha karma you already have. And so I don't want it because I already have it. And I'm not happy.
I want to change it too.
I want to change it because it's here. And I'm not happy. But I'm not happy because, you know, I don't know where the source of happiness is. And so I've projected it out into the world from beginningless time, and then I'm running after it trying to find it. But for a Jivan Mukta, that problem's not there. I'm not projecting the ananda out anymore because I found the source. I found it. I know it. And so my mind staying home relaxes in the prarabdha karma because the prarabdha is already here. I don't need the world to make me happy. And so I can be held by Ishvara, by the prarabdha karma, because it's here. It couldn't be any more here. Just look. Every moment, your life, you are placed, you have a place. Every moment. The place is here. The problem is not that you're in a place. It's that you want another place. But what if you don't want another place? Then this place is fine. And in samsara, sometimes the place is fine and you're fine. But for a jnani, the place is always fine because the ananda has nothing to do with the place. So you let Ishvara, whatever Ishvara is doing, you can talk like that. Whatever Ishvara is doing, whatever the prarabdha karma is, that's what I'm dealing with. That's my lot. It's either good or it's bad, and I handle it. Whatever it is, I handle it. But not so that I can become happy. That's not the reason. Because the ananda is already there. I've discovered it. I have knowledge. And so then that karma yoga buddhi, what starts as a karma yoga buddhi until you get knowledge, where I just take everything that happens as prasad from the Lord. As in a temple, when they give the prasad, I just take everything as prasad. That's how I manage, because I understand all of this is Ishvara. I still see myself as different. But for a jnani, I see everything as Ishvara. This body, mind, sense organs, all of the karmas, everything that's happening in the whole creation, I see all of it as Ishvara, and I let Ishvara unfold. I let the life unfold because I don't need it to be different, and actually it's fine how it is. I do my best in the situation that's given. That's what Swamiji says, you know. I just do what's here to be done, and I do my best. And that's great. That's the Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. That's kind of the way to worship Ishvara. You just, as the life is of progressing, you just do your best at situation after situation after situation, enjoying your own ananda. None of this works. It's all meaningless if you're not enjoying your own ananda. But you know what? When you are happy, full, you really don't want anything to be different. You do what is there to be done. You want something to be different if somebody's in pain or if there's something, you're being called to do something, then, but for your own well-being, if you are enjoying your own ananda, then you don't want that ananda to be different. Oh, let's change that ananda. We don't think like that. When that fullness or wholeness is there, all the mind wants is for it to be there. You know? And so that's what allows this Ishvara Buddhi to be there. That's why knowledge is so complete. It's not just having a meditative experience. You know, it's really the total understanding that I am all of this. And it's not enough for somebody, some guru, to come along and say, you are all of this, be happy. There's nothing but you here. You have to understand. The Upanishad can unfold it, you know, but you have to understand. Understanding requires your mind. Understanding, the mind needs logic. It needs to be able to say, well, this is like this because of this and because of this and because of this. And I understand that, you know. And it has to be so thorough that if you think that it's going to be another way, but like your mind will say, yeah, this is like this and like this and like this, but couldn't it be like that? And then your mind has to say, no, it can't be like that because of this and because of this and because of this. You have clarity. You have clarity. Otherwise, you walk around trying to shut your mind up so you can have an experience, you know. But you can't let your mind isn't free to think. Your mind isn't free to be a mind. Your mind should be free to be a mind, to think and to question and want to know and understand. A lot of times people are trying to say, knowledge, self-knowledge, liberation is beyond your mind. And so now what are you supposed to do with your mind? It's beyond your mind. So you have to understand that it's beyond your mind. The self is beyond your mind. And so somehow you have to turn the mind off somehow. There's these notions that go around. So just one set of them. But these are the notions that we have to just explore. Does having self-knowledge or gaining self-knowledge mean that you shouldn't have a mind, or you have to quieten your mind, or that you have to go beyond your mind? What does that mean? What exactly does that mean, to go beyond your mind? In some ways, that's true, but you have to know what that means. You have to see the very truth of your mind, which is free of your mind. The truth of your mind is the self of the mind, but the self of the mind is free of the mind. That's the satyamitya. So you have to understand all that. That's not at all saying that you can't have a mind and that your mind can't think. You know? And so here, all what Gaudapada is doing here, and he's started now really, really beautifully, he's starting, is to prove, and this whole chapter, he is going to prove and establish beyond any doubt for you that this world is mithya. That the waking state, as well as the dream state, is mithya, which is exactly what the Upanishad says. It doesn't use the word mithya, but it establishes the mithyatva. Now this, he has to go through and logically make you recognize your experience of this world, which includes your body, your mind, your sense organs, your perception, the whole universe, to understand it as mithya logically, how it has to be that way, logically. So that's what he's doing. That's good enough. So we made it through verse 4. But anyway, this verse is the verse that the rest of the chapter is going to be establishing. This verse doesn't prove anything. It's just making the statement. that both are, you know, that the world is, that the waking state is mitya, in the same way that the dream state is. It only says one thing here as well, because both of them are inside. Both of them are inside as the vrittis that are known, but there's a difference because one's subjective, one's objective. But now the question will come up and say, well, how does, just because they're both inside, how does that make it mitya? How does that make, what does that mean? You know, and so one question after another he has to answer and bring in other arguments to prove that this world is mitya. So that's why it's called the Vaitatya Prakaranam. Vaitatya means mitya. So it's the section that deals with the mityatva of the universe. After the mityatva of this universe is established, then you can establish the satyam. You know, as long as this world is considered to be real, have real substance, you can't establish satyam. You have to negate this first and show how there's nothing here that can be considered to be real satyam. So that's what he has to do. Okay. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Could you run this by me one more time about how if the dream can't fit inside my mind, or what was that all about?
At the beginning, you might go back and just for your own sake study the first few verses, but we all accept that the dream is mitya.
Yeah, that's right? Easy to see.
That's easy to see. So we know that the dream's appearance, not real, all these things. We understand that. We don't understand that the waking state is mitya.
Right.
And so we have to prove that the waking state is as mitya as this dream state. There are some things about the waking state and the dream state that are exactly the same, that is going to end up establishing the mityatva of the waking state. There is something also, though, that is different. What is different, because otherwise we just say the waking state is the dream state. They're different. Why are they different? Well, because the dream state obviously just takes place inside my head. Okay. When I wake up, I can see, you know, that I didn't go anywhere. Yeah. I dreamt of India. I couldn't have got to India. I dreamt of a whole world, you know, but I didn't leave. I didn't go anywhere. So that world was taking place inside my head. That world can't fit inside my head. There's no time to go anyplace. And so that dream state has to be subjective. It is different in that way from the waking state, because in the waking state there is time. I would have to travel to India. I'm seeing a world that is outside of this body.
Yeah, so it's surreal.
So it has an objective reality. This has a subjective reality. That's how they're different.
Right.
But then, when we start analyzing, accepting this difference, when we start analyzing the shared subject-object relationship that the two enjoy, that both are drishya, objectified, that both, in fact, in terms of my personal experience, the waking, what I perceive through my sense organs takes place in a vritti which is internal, in the same way that the dream state takes place in a vritti that is internal.
Mm-hmm.
The subject-object relationship is the same.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they've done so far. So they're only using this samvritta dvaina, this being small, in a small space, as a way, and also the distance, you know, taking place in the dream that doesn't take place in reality, to show that the dream state is really different than the waking state. One is subjective, taking place in my head. The other is objective.
Ishwaras.
Yeah. Jiva Srishti and Ishwara Srishti, like that. So he's looking, so you knowing, so now we accept that the two are different, that they're not both waking state. One is subjective dream, one is waking state, you know. But now when we start, but there's something so much the same, you know, like the subject-object relationship, internal to both,
mm-hmm.
you know, the drishyatvam, both being perceived, all of these type of things. There's something very similar to these two. One you know to be mitya, the other you think is real. And so this, now he's just starting, this is one, we're going to be comparing the dream with the waking in certain ways. And now he's going to go on to another comparison in the verse 6, you know, that are true for both of them, and bringing in mirage water and these type of things.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we're going to keep working on this then.
Oh, yeah. That No. All that's being happened now is that he's establishing what you call the logical, the pratijna. The pratijna is this, like the dream state, means the logical syllogism is going to be like this. The waking state is mitya, just like the dream. That's the drishtanta. The waking state is mitya, vaitatya, just like the dream. Why? Because drishyatvat, because both are perceived.
Hmm.
He said that, but he hasn't established it yet. He's saying it. He's just starting to establish it. The whole chapter establishes it. You're going to get to a position where, because something is perceived, it has to be mitya. Just by the very fact that it's objectified, it must be mitya. But he hasn't established it yet. He's put what we call the pratijna, the logical syllogism. Pratijna is the first statement of a logical syllogism. The first statement is the waking state is mitya. How is it mitya? It's drishyatvat, because of being seen, like the dream. That's the whole syllogism. But now we have to establish it. How does drishyatvat, you say, how does being seen
make it mitya?
How could that, you know? And so now we have to unfold that, how that's true. And that's what he's going to do. You know? That's why the Mandukya Upanishad is always the last Upanishad taught. Usually. Because after it's taught, then you don't need any, you don't want anything else.
Yeah.
It's over.
Well, it's kind of a head cracker. I mean, this is, I mean,
it clearly cracks your head. It ends because it's very thorough, you know. Very just goes along, and you have to see.
And this is not the Upanishad, though. This is
This is Gaudapada giving a logical yukti, the logical unfoldment of what the Upanishad says. It's not like a bhasha. The bhasha gives the meaning of the Upanishad and gives what we call purvapaksha siddhanta, objection and answer, but The Karika, it keeps the vision of the Upanishad in mind. And then it develops it and unfolds it in its own way.
And then Shankar is writing a commentary on that remark that Gaudapada is making.
Yeah. And Gaudapada is Shankara's guru's guru. And so what Swamiji says is, really out of respect for Gaudapada, Shankara is commenting on the Karika, not on the Upanishad.
Yeah.
Did very little commentary on the Upanishad. All the commentary is really even on Gaudapada's Karika. In chapter 1, his Karika is of the Upanishad. And now in the Vaitetya Prakarana, he's going on to establish the Mityatva that the Upanishad is suggests telling. And then the Satyam in the next one. In the last one, he's looking at all kinds of objections. Different schools of thought might say this or that, and then he's answering all of those.
Well, after we do that, maybe we should go back and do the Upanishad again.
Mm-hmm. We should retire. After the 3 years or so it takes us to get all the way through this, if we go straight through, we might. Last time we did it was several years ago, we just did chapter 1, the Agama Prakarana. I'm at least going to do chapter 2 this time. Maybe we'll just keep going. It's a little bit... it is what it is. It's different than the Gita. You know, the Gita, there's, you know, we're looking at Antakarna Shuddhi and all this. This is just vision. I can bring all these other things in too, but it's really vision.
Well, it's a little bit
understanding.
It's a little bit challenging because it makes you think differently than you think.
Totally. We don't come to this knowledge thinking I'm the whole. I'm Ishwara. You come to this knowledge thinking I'm a jiva. I'm an individual in this creation. I don't know who I am really. You know? I don't know who God is. I don't know what I'm really doing here. I remember when I was in high school trying to figure out, why am I here? What am I doing here? What's the purpose? We don't know anything. And then the vision of the Upanishad is so... You go from being a jiva in the creation to being the whole. So...
It seems like, though, there's, you know... In the tradition, there's so much emphasis on devotion and accepting everything as emphasized. But then also when you talk about it, sometimes it kind of sounds like it's a first step. Like it's not, like you just do that for a while until you get it.
I don't think so. You know why? The motivation might be different. But in the end, this is all Ishwara.
Yeah.
You know, which is, and then your body, mind, sense organs is part of this whole. So that what they might call bhakti and jnanam, all these things are just natural. The jnanam itself is bhakti. The bhakti is jnanam. They're not different. That's why that beautiful verse in Manisha Panchakam, the end he says, just in one verse he says, as a prayer to Bhagavan, this is Shankara writing. He says, from the standpoint of this body, to Shiva, he says, from the standpoint of this body, I'm your servant. From the standpoint of this mind, I'm your bhakta, I'm your devotee. From the standpoint of me, I'm you. Right? Because this body is part of Ishwara, you know, and the mind is part of you in regard to heart, part of Ishwara.
Well,
and so the ananda, the very love, is the very swarupa. So that bhakti is something, we think of it, it's something that is natural. You shouldn't think of just bhakti as somebody who does puja is doing bhakti. There's infinite ways of expressing that shraddha and devotion and wonder. And You can be doing puja too. You can be doing puja, you can be doing bhajans, you can be studying the shastra, you can be taking a walk in nature. There's not just one expression of bhakti.
Well, it seems to me if you really have a firmness and understanding that this is Ishvara, what other position would you have except, whoa, look at this? You know?
That's right, kind of like that.
Yeah, but if you don't, then it seems to me almost like it's reinforcing duality. Like you just are...
Do you mean like if you do puja?
Yeah.
Not really, well... From the karma yoga standpoint, where that kartritvam, that doership is still there, then that puja and taking everything as prasada is a way that kind of thins out the ahankara, right? Because you're in constant relationship with Ishvara. When you have knowledge, you're in constant relationship with Ishvara because this is all Ishvara, right? But you can know that you're the whole. And from the standpoint of this jiva upadi, sing bhajans, do pujas, enjoy the whole thing with knowledge. That's why Shankara has written so many beautiful suktas, and suktas means they're songs and poetries and things that are just praising Ishvara or praising Saraswati, you know. That doesn't make him an ajnani. It's just appreciating Ishvara. Mm-hmm. Like even going to the Dakshinamurti puja, like to watch the puja. When I'm there, I usually go for the whole thing every morning, just because I just like to be there. But I don't become an ajnani because I'm at the puja.
No.
But I'm at the puja because I like it.
Well,
and it's beautiful, you know.
That puja sort of adds on to, that atmosphere adds on to what you've reminds you of what you already have understood.
Yeah, or puts you in that place where that is all being worshipped in a way.
Yeah.
Even if you understand the Sanskrit of what they're chanting, all of it, you know, like the Vishnu Sahasranama that we're studying? All of the things that are being chanted are just, it's just this knowledge in all different kinds of forms. So just to sit in the midst of that is really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to. It doesn't mean, one doesn't, sitting there, you don't become less of a jnani, and not sitting there, you don't become more of one. It doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
There's something about, it's funny because I really feel strongly in devotion and prayer that it like helps me with this knowledge, but at the same time there's like an aspect to it that I find really confusing when I think about it. And like even that Dakshinamurti prayer that we do, asking for like wealth and health and all those things, the more I think about that, the less sense it makes to me, because it's like, why would I ask for anything? Why would I ask for anything to be different if I'm trying to accept everything? I don't know.
Because you have the freedom to ask for it.
Why would you want it?
I would say like this, that I think this is kind of actually really an important thing to understand, because otherwise you won't be free. You know? Say if... just even as part of your prarabdha, there'll be desires are going to come up. I want this, or I want to do this. You have a pravritti to do something. Mm-hmm. That'll come up through your whole life. You have preferences through your whole life. Even with Jnana-nishtha, Swamiji, total maturity, you have preferences, you have desires, you have things you go toward, things that you want. But it is fine if you don't get them. It's okay. There's nobody inside that starts weeping because you don't get your desire is fulfilled. You just deal with whatever that is, you know? And so you're free to have desire, because the desire template is much different. For a samsari, the desire template is like this, and it's a serious thing. The whole template is here. I want this so that I can be happy. That's samsara. I want this. I need this. so that I can be happy. I don't want this so that I can be happy. Either way, that so that I can be happy is a real thing, because I don't take myself to be ananda or fullness. I have to become happy. I have to make myself happy. I have to make my way to become whole and complete. That's not true for a jnani. So out of happiness I go after this, or out of happiness I go after that. If I don't get it, that's fine. But really, without desire, it's called pravritti and nivritti, you can't even move. You know? There's no reason to get up. There's no reason to do anything. You know, so desire and preferences are just a natural part of life. But are you free? Are you free to have the desire and have it not work out? That's what happens, you know. So I would, you know, if we say the Mula Mantra, a lot of these are different types of Dakshinamurti Mantra, and the Shantipatas. All of these are asking, in one way or another, let me be happy, let me be healthy, let me have Medha Shakti, let me have enough money so that I don't have to worry about that, just so that I can sit and study and be with this knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of the Shantipatas are like that. For a student who's studying, all of these Shantipatas, in one way, they're asking for ideal conditions for this knowledge to take place. Mm-hmm. You know?
It's really practical.
Yeah, it's practical. But say you have knowledge, and then you're doing the Shantipatas. You know, I do all those Shantipatas, and I want all those things to be there when I'm doing them. When I say those things, like Sahanabhavatu, let us all be nourished by this knowledge, let there not be any animosity, all of these, they're very important prayers. Mm-hmm. So I want all of those things.
So when you're asking for wealth from Dakshinamurti, it's not like you want to be one of the Koch brothers, it's you want just to be able to survive?
I actually don't even think about it. but all I'm trying to say is that it's not something to worry about. And if you're worried about it, then we have to see, well, why? Why? What is the worry? Because yeah, there's different. I can answer this on a lot of different levels. There's another one level that is important also. No, I don't think I want to go there now.
What time is it?
What you're saying on one level is true, but if you take that position, then your mind's not free in terms of the prarabdha. You know, like say if you say it's wrong to say these type of prayers because that means I'm not a jnani. If I were a jnani, then I wouldn't pray to Ishwara. But the jiva is here, this body, mind, sense organs that has its own, the jiva is by nature limited and is in relationship to the whole, just like you and I are in relationship. Like, we have a relationship and we can talk to each other and we can say things to each other, you know, we can need things from each other because we're humans and we take care of each other. It's all mitya. Really, there's only conscious being here. So why would I come into relationship with any of you or want your presence or anything like that? But I do come into relationship and I do want your presence. We don't want to be just isolated beings because we're human beings. So we're also in relationship to Ishwara. At the same time, I am Ishwara. But from the standpoint of this jiva, I'm in relationship to Ishwara. You know? And so, like, say your child is sick or someone is hurting or something. You're in relationship to Ishwara. It's natural for somebody that you love to say prayer, you know. That's just being human. But that doesn't mean that you don't know on every level who you are and who Ishwara is, and you don't need to stop your humanness. You're free to be human. And that's one of the beautiful things, I think, about knowledge. And I think it's really important to sit with it also, because we can get into a place where it's not all right to be human, you know? Not that you're doing that, but I'm just saying that we can do that. Mm-hmm. Where it's not all right to have feelings, it's not all right to have emotions, it's not all right to have love or to mm-hmm. care for people or to enjoy people's company, all of these things. Then what do we think is all right? What would that person end up being like? You have to think, well, in the end, and this is more like actually yoga, mm-hmm. in the Patanjali yoga with more of a Sankhya bent, where what really would show that I have knowledge is that I sit in Nirvikalpa Samadhi all the time. Mm-hmm. And actually, in the Sankhya yoga, that is where they go. That if I really had knowledge, all I would do would be sitting in Nirvikalpa Samadhi, and I would have
no thought,
no care, no interaction. And in fact, I would have to be very careful about that, because it's like a bouncing ball. That's the example they use, bouncing ball into samsara. You know, that's the potential of yoga with the Sankhya yoga bent. So that means, and the reason for that is that they take the prakriti to be a separate, existent entity from the many purushas that are there. Each one is pure consciousness. What you have to do is totally shut down the prakriti. You know, you have to turn it around, make it have an anuvritti, like just flow continually, flow into just the purusha, so that there is nothing in your... You have to work to get a good asana so that you can just let the body go and let the mind totally withdraw completely from the prakriti. And there's a lot of ways and things that you have to do. You have to have, you know, dharma and good qualities and all of these type of things, the yama, niyamas, all of this, so that the mind's not pulling you back, so that you can eventually just shut the whole thing down and just abide, have the prakriti totally shut down, and then the purusha will just abide in its own conscious being without any consciousness of any of the creation at all. Because the creation is prakriti, which is a different physical existent reality of its own. And so I feel like what's happened in the West especially is that we've had a lot of this yoga, these yogic ideas over especially the last 50 years come over to give us some concepts of liberation. And, you know, that have to do with total annihilation of any need or want in the creation to the point of being sitting in Nirvikalpa Samadhi all the time. That's different versions of this have come over. And what's happened, and that's not Vedanta at all, but what's happened because of that is that just what it means just to be a person, you know, who is free because of recognizing your own self and recognizing Ishvara, has had superimposed on that freedom all kinds of limitations that are brought about because
restrictions
brought about because of yoga. Yogic concepts. It's not really even potentially yoga. Nobody even knows potentially yoga. It's just different things, yogic type things that have come over that have kind of confused the issue. Because really, if you think about it, if you go that way, you can't have really a relationship with a real relationship with Ishvara. We can't have a relationship with ourselves either. Mm-hmm. Because that's dual too. Right? This is as mitya, as the relationship between the jiva and Ishvara. It's all mitya, if you want to look at it that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then if you stick with Ishvara Srishti, not the jiva superimposition, then as long as the jiva is following dharma and has an antakarana shuddhi, a purity of mind that is brought about really from the following of Dharma, that person gains knowledge, and then that person enjoying Ananda lives out their Prarabdha. The whole picture is there. But you don't have to worry about what you're thinking or how you're praying or things like that.
It feels really silly to like, but I can say I have a friend who's sick and I want to pray that they get better.
Yeah.
But I can talk myself out of it because I'm like, well, maybe that's what they need right now is to be sick in that way. How do I know that they should get better? Like, this is the right thing for them and they're going to gain knowledge that way.
But we have a counteraction for that because that's something true about that. So you always say, even for your own prayers, you know, you say, if it be your will.
Yeah.
And then you pray. Because we don't know. But still, it's natural to pray. To pray that, you know, sometimes that's all we can do is pray. You know? But you always know at the same time, Bhagavan knows best. Because total knowledge, you know. But that doesn't mean that it's wrong to pray. And in fact, they look at prayer as a karma. It's a manasa karma. It's not... Prayer is considered... Like, look at... If you take an action, like say your friend is sick, and you say, oh, my friend is sick, I'm going to go get her some food, you know, and see if she needs any medicines or whatever. And so you take that action. That's a karma that you're doing. And then manasa karma is also a karma. What if you said, I'm not just going to take her food, I'm going to pray to Bhagavan, to try to evoke Bhagavan's grace. You know, that's also a karma. That's a good way to think of prayer as a karma. It's a mental karma.
And that'll bring
an intention.
That'll bring a result, right? But
well, it brings whatever result it is. I mean, Bhagavan could say, no, it's not good for her, I'm not going to answer that prayer.
Can it bring a result that actually manifests itself?
I think that it can. In fact, you know, they've done a lot of studies now, more and more studies on the efficacy of prayer, and they actually find that it does make a difference that's statistically relevant difference. I just read another study on that. It does make a difference. You know what? And if you think about it, just in kind of a simple way, if you walk into a room, a group of people, and there's one person there that really likes you and so happy to see you, that affects you, right? And if there's somebody in the room that really hates you, that affects you, right?
Yeah.
We don't necessarily, I mean, if I say that to anybody, sometimes I tell my students in class this, and everybody goes, yeah, I mean, it's obvious, right? It has an effect. So prayer has an effect. It has an effect, you know?
So it's not hocus pocus. I mean, you know, we've also been taught that.
Well, I don't see it as hocus pocus at all, but sometimes you have to give little simple logics that bring it down to kind of the practical reality that it enjoys, you know?
Sometimes I find that, because I totally understand, I think, where she's coming from, and it's like for myself too, I've started to feel like when I do pray, it creates this sort of calmness in my mind, so that if, say, that there's some other way things can unfold, my mind is calm enough that I can actually see it. And for me, with prayer, because I've also had the same thing growing up, more of a fundamentalist Christian, that I've had the same concern. It's like, oh, well, am I now putting myself more into, like, the duality? But to just kind of settle my mind and have faith that, you know, things will unfold exactly the way they're supposed to. And I do pray that it is for the best for everyone that I'm aware of and that I'll never come in contact with. And it seems to manage to relax things where it's like, oh, I didn't even see that option over there.
Which, yeah. But yeah, you're saying a prayer that's kind of bringing your knowledge to play, to kind of allow Ishwara to unfold.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think in the end is what really gives us the most freedom. Because if you're allowing Ishwara to unfold, then Ishwara is there, right? Then you're in relationship to Ishwara. You know?
And for me, I'll even, like, I really don't want it. Unless it's what's supposed to happen, kind of a thing. And it makes it easier for me to make small decisions and should I go to the movies or should I buy that house?
And that's also a prayer that a lot of us will say is like, you may want something, but I really don't want it if it goes against the prarabdha, because then you're just creating a problem for yourself. But you know what's good about all these are dialogues. It means you're in relationship to Ishwara. That's the good thing, you know. All of your prayers, everything that you want. The relationship is real as opposed to not having any relationship. And if I want something, why shouldn't I be able to say I want that? And then as I can say, well, you know, I want that, but I really don't want it if it's not in my best interest. But that's relationship. It means that Ishwara is becoming the one that you're most intimately related to in a real way.
Well, it gives you kind of an access.
Yeah, but what I mean, when I say in a real way, mm-hmm. I mean in what is real to you at this time, instead of thinking that what you should be. Because then that's like an almost emotional bypass. To be a jnani, I should be like this, so I can't tell Ishwara what I really want. See what I mean? We want to be able to have that real relationship. And then let your knowledge and your desires just take care of themselves. But not in a way where you're afraid to be real with Ishwara. That being real with Ishwara is more important than trying to figure out what you're supposed to be like if you're jnani.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's where we should stop.
This Galfar is quite a character, isn't he?